This is episode 139 of How to Human. And in this episode, I'm going to continue my feminism series. And today we are on second wave feminism. It began in the 1960s. And the main theme of it was independence. So coming out of first wave feminism, what came about there was really about understanding that women were people. But even as people, they were still second class. So they could vote, and they had some access to education and some access to property rights, meaning they could, like, it's hard to imagine, right? It's hard to imagine from today's lens that women would have trouble owning property on their own. But such things existed, and getting the property after they died, like if it... All details I don't know. I'll be honest, some of this is just generalizations from Wikipedia articles and sort of ideas that I've understood, but the universality of some of these things, like that, for example, if gay marriage was illegal in 38 states, but illegal in 12, the passing of a gay marriage, well, in this case, it was a Supreme Court ruling, but any kind of universal law that would make it real is different than some level of things. In some states, there were places where women could own property, and it was about the universality of it, about the public consciousness around, and then laws giving women access to more rights. So women had rights coming out of first wave feminism, but not all of them. There were still pay inequities and lots of discrimination and sort of this public idea that women were less important. Women were generally moms or secretaries, but that we didn't have to prioritize their needs and wants. And so, particularly after the Second World War, when a lot of men went away and then they came back, and during that time, women were filling more roles, and they sort of saw themselves as more than male decorations. And that's a big statement, but you are what your vision of what you're capable of comes from what you're told you're capable of. So if you're told housewife and mom is your destiny, you might believe it unless somebody tells you different. And then when World War II started and women got out of the house more, there's so much isolation in being like a housewife, and they get to see more of it. It started something. It started probably a greater awareness as a group that we're not happy with things being under the way that men are defining our roles doesn't work for us. And that sat in the public consciousness for a while. 1950s, we generally think of as the white picket fence times with Leave It to Beaver, ideas of what a family looked like. And I know I'm generally covering the white experience in America. And I will be covering second wave feminism in the 60s without discussing civil rights for the most part. And that very well could be racist. I don't know. It very well could be that I'm missing nuance here that should be here. And it is, of course, typical for a white man to leave out the black experience or the experience of the other marginalized. But I'm trying to tell a story just about feminism. And there are places where there is the civil rights movement and the feminism movements come together. But right now, I just want to discuss feminism. So as the 60s started, it seemed like, you know, I think about this. In Maslow's hierarchy of needs, there are your basic needs for survival, and then there's connection and love, and you just sort of get all your needs met. And then all of a sudden you realize, well, I have all my needs met, but where's my happiness? Happiness is sort of the top piece. It's actually self-actualization, which is a sort of a different idea, but once you're comfortable, you start thinking about how to maximize that comfortability, maximize that comfort, maximize your experience for something better. And so this is also why it started in America, probably, that as the richest world, we had the richest people, and the richest people had the most comfortable lives. And then they were, as people, seeking to maximize their happiness. And as women sought to maximize their happiness, they said, being moms and housewives and secretaries doesn't work for us. We seek something greater. We seek not to be trivialized as human beings, being second-class citizens, as defined by men who are generally running the society and defining who we are and what we're capable of. Seems like a pretty reasonable want. So the next goal was to... Independence is how I described second wave feminism. And I'd say that's right. Next goal was independence. Because if the view was women need men to survive, women are never really equal or capable. They are still always looking for something or someone else to make their lives complete. And so in order to have their own level of completion without the men who are defining who they are and defining who they are as people who need others. So it's the male view that created, it's sort of a cycle. Men get to define what women are, and what they define is women who need men. So that process just carries itself forward unless women stand up and say, no, we don't need men. We don't need men to define us, and we don't need men to make us happy. And so started this second wave of feminism. And it was about law changes, for sure. It was about cultural changes also. And one of the first parts of it was the birth control pill in 1961. Because before that, sex was always not probable to lead to pregnancy. I've heard that the rate that any woman might become pregnant from a sex act is 15%, and I presume that's while she's ovulating, because the number is zero if you're not, it's not zero if you're not ovulating, but it's much lower. So I'm going to say my memory. Dave Mesmer, you should look this up before you say it. No, I'm not going to do that. The rate of getting a woman pregnant when she's ovulating is 15%. So reduce that down to zero with the birth control pill, and then it allows women a different level of freedom. The freedom to, well, among other things, have sex for pleasure, have sex for reasons other than, but to have it without fear of procreation, because it's this limiting thing to be pregnant and then be beholden to children that keeps you from being in the workplace, particularly if the environment suggests that if you're a mom, that you must be, that is your role. But separate from not being a mom, you can choose to have a sexual life and delay your child-rearing times to later because you want to have a career. I think of second wave feminism a lot about career choice, that secretaries aren't the only option. Women can be CEOs if they want to. And so a whole lot of things need to change in order for that to happen. There needs to be a recognition that women are capable of being CEOs. They need to be trained to be CEOs. There needs to be a public change to think that women can be leaders. There needs to be an entire rethinking of where women's wants and priorities live in how men think about them. So if there's a list of things that women want, those always fell to the bottom of what men wanted. Like men, what men wanted, if men were defining the priorities, men would put their priorities first. I made a podcast, it's podcast number 48, on the pros and cons of homogeneous and heterogeneous groups. That was a good one that talked about this. That if we put a bunch of men in a room and say, let's make culture, they're probably going to make it from their own lens. And consciously or unconsciously, going to make that culture with their needs in mind. It's pretty easy to say that that was true for most of human history. So that's where first wave feminism, that's where feminism comes in. It's, we are tired of living under your boot. Your boot doesn't take our needs into account. Therefore, you need to, our voices need to be heard. So, and we're going to gather together, speak loudly, and demand our needs be heard and met. So that was first wave feminism, and then this was second wave feminism. They wanted to not be looked at as sex objects. They didn't want their opinions and capabilities to be dismissed. So much of, you're just a woman, you can't do that. You can't do that, run that company, you can't perform that job. You can't carry that load. As in, like a physical load. And there were lots of generalizations about what women were physically, emotionally, psychologically, and intellectually capable of. And those were taken as givens. And that existed not just in the public consciousness, but also in media. TV and movies would further these ideas. And culture comes from what we say out loud. So when we say out loud that this is what women are, that becomes what we believe that women are capable of. So changing the media was part of that too, changing the narrative that women were capable of more. So as women defined their own needs, as they started gathering together and demanding their voices be heard, changes started happening. There are several things that happened via law. I have a small list here. 1967, full affirmative action rights were granted to women. 1968, there's a ruling on sex discrimination in ads there's a ruling against it. They had Title IX, for women's education equality. There's a Pregnancy Discrimination Act in 1978. Roe v. Wade was in 1973. That's a little bit of a more complicated one. There are pro-life feminists. It is generally, that's complicated. It's complicated because I'm discussing abortion. The idea that abortion is universally considered a pro-feminist argument, even though there are pro-life, meaning anti-abortion feminists. The idea that women can and should be able to control their own bodies, and then abortion's a complex topic, probably for a different podcast. So let's skip it for now. They must want to hear about abortion. Well, you're not going to. What really women were looking for was true equality as people. True, the ability to walk around as human beings. So I described first wave feminism as a want for humanity, that they could have opinions that actually counted. And they kind of got it. They got to vote. But they were still subject to this male-centered lens of them being inferior. and being inferior, it hurts one's self-esteem. I have a friend who wrote on Facebook about, it's either Mennonite or Amish. She went to a Mennonite or Amish store, and she could just detect that this young woman had been told her whole life that she was less intelligent, that she was less capable, that the men do the hard intellectual work and that women don't. It's just not, they're not capable of it. And that was a narrative. And it's an ugly narrative that's also untrue. So a lot of it was undoing these cultural narratives that persisted because they were created generally by men. Women were obviously weren't the ones who said that. So some of that was a fight back against what was considered the oppressive cultural norms created by men. And there were so many different roles that men had traditionally only served on, right? Things like politics. And of course, politics is important because it's the way that laws are created. And so women need to have their voices heard. Women need to have their voices heard in terms of opinions that go into policy creation, but without being in policy creation, by being in the legislative areas, they weren't going to get their ideas enacted as efficiently or as completely. Elite schools, private clubs, Congress, the Supreme Court, these things were all limited by your genitalia for most of the 20th century. And that's what second wave feminism was trying to undo. The attitude that you're just a woman. There's an attitude of male superiority. I read, as I was researching this, Gloria Steinem's start. She went undercover to a Playboy club. And in 1963, she published a two-part series in something called Show that talked about how she was treated and how, as you can imagine, just like what that would look like with an old boys club and men probably playing grab ass and women just have to deal with it and smile and pretend like nothing's wrong. Meanwhile, they're expected to put up with crap that is dehumanizing. That's probably the larger point, is that a lot of this is dehumanizing. It's dehumanizing to be a second-class citizen. And that's how it fits into the civil rights movement, is that we have Black people also being dehumanized. And they found common ground in being oppressed by societal narratives. So they worked together a lot, particularly in the late 60s. We saw, going back to feminism, some of this also came down to male standards for beauty. We saw women burning bras and growing out their armpit hair, not shaving their legs. Women were tired of being told what to be. And I can't blame them. Who wants to be told what you are and who you are? Why are you being put in a box that isn't of your own choosing? That is neither, that's not freedom. If this is the country of freedom, the shining city on the hill, then people should be able to be whatever they want to be. And like I said, we started first with feminism because we're the richest nation. And we're able to have first world problems. Not that I'm calling the trivialization of women a first world problem, but it, with having all your needs met and you get to think about what could be better, That's how, why it started in the United States. And that's why it spread from the United States to other countries. Because we were the richest, we were the first ones to realize the second level of happiness. The first level is getting your needs met. The second level is the existential wants for happiness. What am I missing here? So, second wave feminism was about women gaining power. They gained rights in first wave feminism, but they didn't have power. They didn't have an equal seat at the table. And they were looking for an equal seat at the table in law, in culture, and in media. And they did a pretty good job. They did a great job. Things changed drastically. It wasn't perfect. Oh, I didn't even put the Equal Pay Act on there. There was an Equal Pay Act as well that was signed in 1963. And then the immediate thing comes, well, did mass men women earn 77 cents on the dollar for men? That's a different issue that I'm not going to get into right now because that also involves career choice. Because women in general choose different careers than men. But I'm not getting into that. And that fits into the women earn 77 cents on the dollar. But I believe I did cover everything I wanted to cover on second wave feminism. It is on a personal level. When I think about the women in my life, my mother, my ex-wife, my friends, and different situations they could have been in where they were dehumanized. And by that, I mean told they weren't as good or treated as sexual objects. It does make me mad. It is this weird thing of men to... Men are generally less empathetic. Generally. This isn't to say that men aren't empathetic. They are just less empathetic. And it allows for men to get together and prioritize their own needs. And there's just something about group dynamics where they can... And any group, by the way, any group can otherize a group outside of it and start painting them with a brush of stereotypes and generalizations that allow them to look at that group as a more simplified version of themselves and perhaps convince themselves that other group is something less than or problematic or undeserving of the same level of sympathy or empathy for some reason. This fits a lot of ways, right? This can fit right in with my talks on postmodernism and coming back up with oppressees talking about oppressors or vice versa. It's complicated. And I will point you back to podcast 48 about heterogeneous and homogeneous groups. In summary, second wave feminism was about increased independence and strength of women. It was a furtherance of the original goal of feminism, which is equality, generally speaking. And it's tough because we need to define what equality means. Does it mean the same? Or does it mean having the same rights under the law? Or does it mean having the same abilities in society? Because men and women are different, so they're never going to be exactly equal because those differences are going to manifest themselves and they're going to be emergent results that come from those differences. But at a minimum, the goal was to remove systemic oppressions that existed culturally, in the media, and in law. And it was definitely a start. There was more to come after this, probably more culturally. And we'll talk about that more in third wave feminism and fourth wave feminism. But this was more about the overt stuff, the really in-your-face stuff. Third and fourth wave feminism, in my judgment, talk about the more subtle things. But as discussed, there's, as women grow in education, as they achieve more education in any particular country, which is generally representative of more equality between the sexes, meaning men don't have preferential treatment in regard to education, that women have the same access. Those countries have a corresponding growth in GDP that is noticeable, that countries do better when women are educated and have more rights. So there's value in it. I mean, of course there's value in it. It's also value on a human rights level that women are treated as equals because they're human beings. And I know that sounds ridiculous, but what's more ridiculous is the idea of looking back. And that's how we need to do it. I mean, we look at things through today's lens and we sort of take for granted the things that happened in the past. And in the past, a woman could be fired for being pregnant. And women were told that they were dumb and that they couldn't achieve a lot of different things. And in some houses, in some places, they couldn't speak. Like they, and it's going back a little bit farther, but I mean, but in some places, it's like, woman, I don't want to hear your opinion. Like that, those things existed. And maybe they still exist at some point here, but on a much smaller scale. And what we do is over time we progress and try to make things closer to ideal. And second wave feminism definitely was women crying out and saying, you were treating us unfairly, and this is a load of crap, and this has to change. And if you won't do it for us, because men wouldn't, we will demand it from you. And that's a reasonable want. I can't hate that. The wants here were reasonable. The wants to not be trivialized in general, to not be treated as second-class citizens. So that is the end of this episode of How to Human. If you have comments or death threats, send those to howtohumancdt@gmail.com. If you have not rated this podcast, please do so on iTunes. Or, yeah, I think iTunes is the only place that really matters if you rate it. Rate it 5 stars if you like my voice. Give it 4 stars if you think it's really annoying. And 3 stars if... Don't give it 3 stars. Give it 5 or 4. You'll get karma for it. Probably not. That's the end of this episode of How to Human.